to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John, do you know why Teslas cost so much?
Why, Hank?
Because they charge a lot.
They do. That's a great observation.
Thank you.
I'm shocked, genuinely, that you didn't tell a sock-based dad joke.
There was a time crunch, I have to say.
Just days from now, it's the most important holiday, third most important holiday in all of Nerdfighteria. The Awesome Socks Club.
Uh-huh.
Hank.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the Awesome Socks Club before we answer questions from our listeners, because I'm just going to tell you the truth. When you told me that you were starting a sock subscription where 100% of the proceeds would go to charity, I said, I believe I can quote myself directly, I said, that sounds like a good niche product. A pair of socks is emailed to you every month. The socks have a wonderful design.
Well, we don't email them. That would be amazing if we emailed you the socks. But
you 3D print them at home. No, a pair of socks is mailed to you directly to your house every month. And all of the proceeds, not some, not like we sent a pair of socks to people in need, 100% of the proceeds go to charity. When you told me this idea, I was like, it's a good idea. It's not a great idea. In fact, I believe that I literally said, it's not $1 million idea, but it's a good idea.
It's so close to being $1 million idea now, John.
It's close.
We've raised, I think we've donated $700,000.
We have donated $700,000 to help reduce maternal and child mortality in Sierra Leone and strengthen the healthcare system in Sierra Leone through the Awesome Socks Club. It is incredible. I was wrong. I love being wrong about your ideas. And in 3 days, awesomesocks.club will begin taking subscriptions again, but only for a 10-day period. So just while you're thinking about it, just go to awesomesocks.club right now and sign up to get the email alert when the subscription's open, because they're only open for 10 days. And I really want Hank's $1 million idea to actually be $1 million idea. So go sign up. All the proceeds go to charity. It's incredible what Hank and the team at DFTBA have accomplished through the Awesome Socks Club. And by the way, Hank, I have a broken foot right now. I haven't really talked about this.
Oh my God, I had no idea. What?
Yeah, I haven't really talked about it. We don't have to get into the details, but I'm wearing a boot. And, you know, usually that would mean that my fashion levels are reduced. It's the natural state of things when you're wearing a boot, except
sure, you're booted.
My fashion levels are actually improved because I get to wear my Awesome Socks Club socks every day. And people are like, dang, forget about the boot. Where'd you get those socks?
I do get a lot of compliments on the socks.
Oh, yeah. No,
and I'm
too.
Like, I'm sorry. The club is only open for 10 days a year.
It's an unusual club. We do this to minimize the amount of returns that we have.
Inventory risk is what they call it.
Yes, yeah. Inventory risk. So sign up for awesomesocks.club now.
You go there, there's a banner at the top, you click on the banner, and then you click on the email when available link, and we'll let you know when it's available.
You could be the first person to get this year's Awesome Socks Club. I'm so excited about getting my more awesome socks. It really is.
I know.
It's a little monthly joy in my life.
It's a little delight. Yeah.
I was totally.
I was surprised by them.
I was so wrong. I would say I've never been that wrong, but actually I'm that wrong often.
This was not just a hankering idea. There was a lot of different inputs to this idea at DFTBA. And we did once have a Nerdfighter sock subscription.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and that went away, and we just decided to sort of change the vibe a lot when we launched Awesome Socks, with a lot of input from a lot of great people at DFTBA. So thank you to all of them, and I love it. So and thank you to everybody who's a member now. The biggest compliment though that you have given me about these socks, John, and I know we're talking about socks that no one can get right now, is that you're picky about stuff, maybe a little bit too picky sometimes, where I'm like, all right, Mr. Everything, it has to be just John Green's way. And you got the socks and you were like, you know, Hank, I like these socks a lot. And I that made me feel very good that we
They're my favorite socks now. I will say that was the most backhanded compliment in response to a compliment I have ever received.
You're a very picky guy.
I'll tell you what, I like the socks less than I did 12 seconds ago. That's for sure. But I do like the socks a lot. They're my favorite socks. They're my go-to number one socks in my drawer.
I also like that because they're different patterns, but they're the same sock. I can mix and match, and it's a little less weird.
That's a bridge too far for me. Hank, I do want to answer questions from our listeners. Once again, that's awesomesocks.club. But before we answer questions from our listeners, there's been a big development in the field of could John beat X in hand-to-hand combat?
All right.
Which is that TJ wrote in to say, "Dear John and Hank, John, I love you very much." It's a little too much, TJ, but thank you. "But a 20-pound you could never win a fight with a house cat. There is no possibility. I'm not convinced that current you could win a fight with a house cat. Imagine fighting at your current size against a cougar that's 125 pounds. That's a pretty close approximation to a scaled house cat of 10 pounds. Cougars can easily grab an adult sheep and leap over a 6-foot fence with the sheep in its mouth. Do you seriously mean to tell me that you could defeat that kind of cat? Have you even fought your own house cat? Sure, if you had a baseball bat, you could win. But if you're just walking around the yard and it decides to surprise you, you are going to have some serious issues and you outweigh it by 190 pounds. I love cats, but I know my place, TJ."
Wow. I still think you could beat up a cat, John. I'm on Team John.
I think 20-pound me could beat up a 10-pound cat. But I again, as we've talked about before, I don't think I'd have to use my fists. I think I could use my powers of persuasion.
I do. You do have very strong powers of persuasion, John. I can say this as a person who has been persuaded by you a number of times. However, you have been unable to persuade me to get off Twitter, which is where you are spending most of your powers of persuasion these days.
Not really. I mean, I'm not telling you not to tweet. I'm telling you to reduce the number of tweets that you send by 60%. And by the way, so's Catherine. So's everybody.
I got to say, John.
Half your replies are people saying, "Oof, what if you tweeted a little less?"
What if I only tweet when I'm drunk? What if that's the new rule?
I mean, I feel like.
Because it feels like those ones are better.
I feel like then you might start drinking more, and I don't want that. I love that you're like a classic moderate drinker. Like you're 1 to 2 units and that's it.
Oh gosh. At a time, certainly not per day, just for clarity.
No. Like you max out at 2 units per occurrence.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless it's a very special occasion.
I've seen you have 3 units only once or twice and you were flying.
Like under a table.
I mean.
With Vi from Vi Heart. Like you know? I remember like that your situation.
No, I remember at your bachelor party.
Oh, no. That is the drunkest I've ever been.
You probably had 4 units at your bachelor party, and I thought you were going to barf for like the last 4 hours of the party.
I think I had more than that. I wasn't counting well. You know, this is a legit Dear Hank and John tip. Always know how many drinks you've had.
Yeah, no, keep track of your units. I'm a big believer in that. I know exactly how many units I had that evening, and believe you me, it was more than 4. That evening ended for me at like 3:30 in the morning in a VFW bar at the very back of it, and I was just playing a slot machine. I was playing like a nickel slot machine for like 2 hours. And I looked at my watch, and I was like, oh, I'm tired because it's 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
I've been playing the slots since 4.
It turns out this gambling stuff is pretty addictive. They can really hook you in.
God, I've lost like $60.
Yeah, I was in the basement of the Double Front Chicken one time and I decided to play like a nickel poker on a video machine. And I sat down and I, on my first nickel, won $20. And you know what my first thought was? If I had bet $1.
I would have won.
That's how they get you.
2,000, 4,000. I'm so bad at math.
Whatever, a big number.
That's how they get you.
It is truly. That's programmed to make me Like, yeah. I feel like you're programmed to make me win when I like sit down and spend one nickel so that I'll start playing for a dollar.
Well, one of the observations that my best friend Chris made to me that I think is just so deeply true is that it is much better to lose at a casino than it is to win. Because if you win, you start to think that you're always going to win.
Yes. How many people have been saved by losing?
I mean, I've never won money at a casino, so that's it's one of my...
I have no data points. As far as the anecdotal data goes, you cannot win at a casino.
Yeah, I'm 0 for 400 so far, but I look forward to trying again. I will say, like, I as you know, Hank, like, one of my great character weaknesses is how much I enjoy going to a casino and pretending to be someone who I'm not.
Losing $100?
Yeah, like, and I wear clothes that I would never wear in real life, and I talk to strangers, which I never do in real life, and I sometimes affect accents, and I often pretend, like, when people ask me about my backstory, I'm always like, what's it gonna be tonight?
Well, this is amazing, and then they're like, because you look so much like John Green. And you're like,
I
get that all the time. My name's Pierre Green, Pierre Verde. From Paris. That's you sitting there. And you're like, I am an engineer. I know lots about computers. I worked on the space station.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's
for the French space agency.
It's actually worse than that, to be honest with you. I'm often with Sarah, and Sarah will be like sitting next to me and just like glancing at me like, wait, what?
That's not true.
Wait, we're from Oregon?
Look, here's the situation. I'm not here to make a long-lasting friend. I'm here to have them and me have an experience. And that experience doesn't have to be based in reality. We're in a casino. Like, if it was based in reality, no one would be here.
Yeah. No, I'm in a miniature version of Venice. Like, this is nothing inside here is real or rational.
Yeah. I, on the other hand, am so committed to the idea of winning that the first time I ever went up in a casino, I walked out. I was like, I beat the casino.
There.
The house has nothing on me.
Hank played the game in the casino with the worst odds, and he won a $20 bet. He won $20. Uh-huh. And then he was like, I'm good.
Yeah.
And I was
why would I keep doing this?
I haven't even settled in yet. Like...
It was like right by the elevators too. It was like the first thing you hit when you come off the elevator.
Yeah.
Because of course it has very bad odds, so they want you to play that game. Yeah. But it was when I understood. And so I played that. It was Casino War.
Let's tell them what it was. It's just the game War. Hank turns over a card, the dealer turns over a card. Yep. Whoever's card is higher wins, but if it's a tie, the dealer wins. Like it's the dumbest.
It's very bad odds. Yeah.
But not only that, it's dumb. Like there's nothing to
nothing
it. Like admittedly,
no.
Like
well, I, at least I understood it. You know?
Yeah. And I remember, like, Hank turned over a king, Dio turned over a nine, Hank got a $20 chip, and he just walked away. And I was like, well, that is a different approach.
I was like, what else do people do here in Vegas? Why did you have your bachelor party in Las Vegas? That seems very atypical.
Oh, God. I mean, we had a good time, but only because I was with my friends and you, not because
could have been anywhere.
Of any. We had a couple good dinners. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't
it was
know.
A good time.
It's not, I'll tell you what. It's
we
not,
didn't do a lot of Vegas-y stuff.
I don't think I've been back in the intervening.
I was
back for like a conference for work or something. But
yeah,
no, when I go to a casino, it's always the one in French Lick, Indiana.
Oh, no.
Which is just.
They call it.
Oh, I love.
They call it. There's a place called French Lick. What's the lick and what's French?
French Lick, Indiana is where Larry Bird is from. One of the greatest basketball players of all time. And
is he French?
I don't think so. It used to be like a hot springs kind of healing capital. Like Franklin Delano Roosevelt used to go there sometimes. And it sort of had that reputation.
Sure.
And then it fell on hard times, like all places like that and became a gambling mecca, but only for a very, only for people in Indiana. So it's, I love French Lick, man. That's where I had my 40th birthday party. Sarah's like, where do you want to go? Anywhere on earth. And I was like, I think I want to go to French Lick.
Boy.
Sarah's like, okay.
All right. Well, it's close.
We can have a nice time.
if you ever want to meet John Green's alter ego, Pierre Verde, get on over to French Lick, Indiana.
I mean, after COVID, I'm not going to French Lick right now, Hank. I'm going to be honest.
The area has rich mineral sources, John.
Yeah, I know.
It has rich mineral sources, and those are the Lick, and it was first settled by French people.
There you go. Yeah, Pierre's on hiatus until this whole global pandemic thing is well and truly over.
I can't wait to meet him.
This first question.
Was there a question?
No. I don't know how we got there. This question comes from Elise, who writes, Dear John and Hank, do subatomic particles have color?
Depends on what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to ask this question because I don't know the answer. Not... do they? They don't, right?
So they do not. So they don't have color in the traditional, like, in order to have a color, certain photons, wavelengths of photons have to be absorbed and certain photons have to be reflected. That requires a molecular structure or an atomic structure. So you can't, it cannot happen with subatomic particles because the actual thing that makes the color happens at a atomic, not subatomic level. However, there is a such thing as color charge, which is nothing to do with color. So in that way, they do have color. They have color charge.
What do you mean it has nothing to do with color?
I would like to read you what Richard Feynman had to say about color charge. He said, okay. The idiot physicists, unable to come up with any wonderful Greek words anymore, call this type of polarization by the unfortunate name of color, which has nothing to do with color in the normal sense. He was not pulling any punches. I completely agree with him. We just couldn't come up with another word because, like, we found out all these different properties of subatomic particles, and we had to name them based on something. And so, like, subatomic particles have spin, which is a thing that has, you know, like a momentum similar to what spin would have, but is not really spinning. And we have color, which is a property that has, that exists, I don't know, maybe on a spectrum. I don't understand it well enough. But there's several different colors.
But maybe it's like how somebody might say that something is like colored by violence or colored by love.
Not really. It's like there were three different things. So instead of being like a one or two thing, there were three. And so they're like, they just were like, well, it's red, green, and blue then.
Oh, I see. So they really just created color where none exists.
Yes. Yes. And Feynman was like, you idiot physicists. Literally. He called them idiot physicists.
Yeah, that seems a little aggressive to me. Like
there could have been something. It's confusing.
Yeah. Well, what would you have picked?
I don't know. I think I probably would have had to consult with my friend who works on the French space station, Pierre. I feel like he'd be more qualified than me.
I might have used A, B, and C.
Yeah, like that, like exactly that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Like letter charge?
Letter. Yeah.
Something that people know.
Because then
we
at least know that it's not actually a thing.
Right. Yeah.
You get the idea that it's not what we're saying it is.
That reminds me a little bit of the first time that I ever encountered algebra when I was, I think, in seventh or sixth grade. And the teacher like wrote on the board, like X plus six equals nine. What is X? And I was like, a letter. X is a letter. Why are we introducing English into our math?
Yeah. Yeah, but you got there eventually. You figured it out.
I still wish it had been something a little more abstract than a letter because it still bothers me. Like when I see an X and a Y axis, I always think like, no, they aren't. They're not. They're not X and Y axes. They're up and down and left and right axes.
Yeah.
All right. That's my criticism of the idiot mathematicians, even though my suggestion literally came from their idea. All right.
What question did we answer? Have we answered a question?
Yeah, we answered the question about whether subatomic particles have color. Now you ask.
No,
what?
Before that. Was there one
there
before that?
There was no question before that. I don't know really how just... we got. I have no idea how we got to casinos. None. We were talking about the Awesome Socks Club. I tried to transition into talking about something else. I don't remember.
There was something about drinks.
Yeah, we were talking about the Awesome Socks Club.
Was that not a question?
No, we were talking about...
It was.
It wasn't.
It was, because we were telling somebody not to drink.
I was telling you not to use Twitter so much, which like you brought up out of nowhere in the middle of a conversation.
It really didn't. Okay. It's just a fun conversation.
So just to recap, Hank, we have answered one question.
Uh-huh.
Let's try to answer a second one.
Okay, this one's
We can do it. I believe in us. This one's from Madison, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I realized I used my phone like a pacifier." Oh, God.
That's definitely got to put it in rice. That's a problem.
I'm not concerned about that, although now that you mention it, it is not a good pacifier, Madison. I feel like a pacifier would be a much better pacifier. I said, oh, God, because I just realized that I use my phone like a pacifier.
What does that mean?
Like, all the times that, like, when my kids were little and I would be like, I don't know how to solve your problems.
Oh, right.
Here's a pacifier.
Oh.
I use my phone like that.
On yourself or on your children?
For myself, when I am upset.
Yeah, I probably do that too.
When I need distraction, mm-hmm. when I am seeking, you know,
oblivion.
To not feel the kind of background anguish that seems to accompany a lot of human life, I'm like, oh, I think I'll look at TikTok.
Yeah.
I recently did an update on my phone and I was really upset because it was taking so long and I couldn't use it. I literally could have thrown a temper tantrum. How do I lessen my dependency on my phone? Madison, you have come to the wrong place.
I can tell you what I would do if I had the self-control to do it, which is you have to increase your dependency on other things. Like you have to have you have to develop all of the subroutines for like what to do when there isn't that subroutine, which is such an easy one, right? You know, pick up and look at the pretty thing. It's shiny and pretty and beautiful, and it contains all the world's information. So it's pretty enticing.
It also contains all of the world's misinformation, for the record. Not all of it, but most of the world's misinformation.
Yeah, yeah. So,
that's like saying, like, It
contains infinite content.
It does, and it's so alluring.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget that, and it's just so alluring.
Yeah, but the most alluring thing about it is that once you do it a lot, it's just like this habit routine that runs in your brain, and it's like, I'm not doing anything right now. Might as well mm-hmm. check on Instagram, and that is a difficult thing to interrupt and to replace with something else. But I think it's really good to have diverse routines if we can develop them. It's hard. But and mm-hmm. you know, another one would be like, oh, I don't have anything to do right now, so I will eat, which is a thing that I can have a problem with sometimes, where I just like, oh, I'm like snacking, but only because I didn't have something to do right now. And I didn't want to like be staring at my phone. So a better one would be like a book that I might want to be reading. A better one would be a drawing that I'm working on, or a journal that I'm journaling in, or something like that.
What drawing are you working on?
Well, Catherine draws. Drawing from her experience, not mine.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's good advice. Madison, what I love about your question is that it acknowledges the size of the problem. And I think a lot of us are minimizing the problem. A lot of us are saying, well, I can stop using my phone anytime I want. I don't have to be on Twitter or TikTok. And like I've experienced in my own life that it is actually very, very hard to resist those, for me at least, to resist those temptations in any kind of long-term or systematic way. Mm-hmm. And really for me to do it, I have to make it impossible.
Yeah.
I have to make it impossible to use, because if it is possible to use, even if it is difficult, I will use it. Like for a while I had this block on my computer where I had to like solve an algebra problem in order to get on Twitter. And all it did was make me good at algebra again.
Well, that's not nothing.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not without a benefit. But like the point is that like I was willing to do math, the thing I hate most in the world, in order to access these, you know, private companies that will give me little dopamine rushes in a semi-randomized way.
John, this next question comes from Anna Luisa, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, I want to start making my own kombucha. So I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos on how to do that. But one thing has kept me awake." So many things could be. "What would happen if I just took a big bite out of the SCOBY, the microbial culture? I've yet to acquire mine, and I'm worrying that if I, that I won't have the self-control to not eat it. Thank you, Anna Luisa." John, you know what SCOBY, what a SCOBY is?
Yes.
Do you know what it stands for? Because I was I think people don't realize it's an acronym. It stands for Symbiotic Culture of Bacteria and Yeast. SCOBY.
Mm. Oh God, I'm sorry. I can't get over the question.
You bolded it.
I know. I know. I remember it. I just had forgotten it, and now I'm like seeing only in tunnel vision. I will say this for myself. Uh-huh. I may not have a lot of self control, but I 100% have the self control not to take eat kombucha's SCOBY.
Yeah,
I mean, call me Mr. Willpower, because no problem.
So Deboki researched this, and it is apparently perfectly edible, which makes sense because it's in your kombucha. So it should be, it better be, because it's touching it. Do you remember the first time you ever heard about kombucha, John?
It's something that Sarah drinks, and yeah. I understand that I drink and eat things that are slathered in microbes all day. And I understand that kombucha is delicious and has lots of nutrition and whatever. It's just that it's not for me. I can't do it. And there's some things you can do and some things you can't do. And that's one of the things I can't do.
So I was in my friend's apartment in maybe 2004. So before like kombucha was a thing you could get in grocery stores. And, I was in an environmental studies master's program, so it was pretty,
crunchy
fans of the earth kinds of vibes,
sure,
and of nature and naturalness and that kind of thing. And my friend like busted out of her closet a jar with like a big like 2 gallon jar with one of those big lids, you know, you can barely get your hand around the whole thing. Yeah. So like it wasn't like a. It felt very industrial. It wasn't like a setup where I felt like there was a lot of thought had gone into it. But it was just like, you know, you open it and like, my perspective is if it hisses when you open it, you throw it away. Because there's something growing in there, and it hissed because it's, you know, it's carbonated and it's like the microbes are producing gases. And then just like poured it in a cup and passed the cup around. Like that's how people drank kombucha back then. And so I had some and I was like, I did not like that. Like it was like, it wasn't cold. It was in a jar in a closet. And I don't know if like now there may be a little more sweetened or more flavored, but it just tasted like bubbly vinegar water to me. And I don't like vinegar especially a lot anyway. And so I didn't have another kombucha for a long, long time. And then I had one that like is a bottled kind. And I was like, oh, I see. They've made this more palatable experience. But my experience from watching my friend make kombucha is it seems like it's a fine hobby. But I, as a chemist, am like, that seems dangerous. It seems dangerous because like you don't know what like microbe might get introduced there and is going to spoil your kombucha. Like you'll probably notice if your kombucha is spoiled, but still like that gives me the wrong vibes. And then also like anytime you have a big glass thing with a lot of pressure building up inside of it, that's physically potentially problematic. Like just be careful, follow all the proper precautions. Don't explode a jar in your closet.
The answer to your question is yes, by the way, it is edible.
Yes, it is edible.
And contains many of the same health benefits of kombucha itself. And I know that because I just read it on the internet. which is the most trustworthy. Just Google things, and the first answer is always correct. Why?
And I just Googled, can kombucha explode? And the answer is yes, it can.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be careful with anything, though, Hank. Any hobby comes
with its
risks.
There's always risks. It's true. There are people who jump off mountains, and I think probably the healthier option would be making a delicious microbial brew at home.
Which reminds me that today's podcast is brought to you by eating the SCOBY.
Just taking a big old bite out of it.
I just wanted to say that phrase one more time.
Just sink your teeth on in. This podcast is also brought to you by the French Space Station. It's a very, very little known space station that's up there doing its great work. Thanks to Pierre for all his hard work on the French Space Station.
I was going to try to do a French accent where I say it wasn't easy, but I can't, because the actual accent I do at a casino is my natural Southern accent. But anyway, today's podcast is also brought to you by Casino War. Casino War, number one and only casino game Hank Green has ever played.
This podcast is also brought to you, of course, by the Awesome Socks Club, awesomesocks.club. Again, that's awesomesocks.club. It opens on November 5th, and it's only open for 10 days. So sign up as fast as you can.
We also have a Project for Awesome message from Aimu from New Jersey to Davina. Well, I told you that if you wouldn't help me write this Dear Hank and John personal message by the deadline, that I would just use it to publicly declare my love for you. So, Davina, the deadline has come and gone, and now the whole world knows how much I love you. Love, love, love. There, take that. That's great. It's a high-quality Project for Awesome donation message.
That's great.
Hank, let's try a serious question. We've gotten a number of emails lately along these lines, and this one is from a young person who wrote us to say, Dear John and Hank, what do people do when you learn that your parent might lose their job? How do I make this point in their life better for them? Pumpkins and Penguins, Anonymous. So when we were kids, our dad did switch careers. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit of a, I remember it as scary. I don't know how you remember it, Hank, but I remember it as,
oh yeah,
definitely being,
yeah, it was like one of the, it was the first time when I was like aware that my parents were people and had problems, yeah, and like, and that they might need me. And it was really scary for me to like see mom and dad be upset.
Right.
And I also like not know, you know, yeah, like that uncertainty.
Yeah. And I think that's what this question is, right? Because like a lot of, like when we're really young, our parents sort of insulate us from uncertainty. You know, if we're lucky, I think, and try to insulate us from instability and insecurity. And then at some point you realize like, oh, they're people too. And they're going through hard times, scary times. And you're not fully insulated from it. I think the most important thing, like I come at this question now from the perspective of a parent, and the most important thing that any parent wants is to know that their kid is okay. And, you know, that's all I want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want to have a job so that my kids are okay.
Right. And so like there are, in times of uncertainty, there are like, you know, there are things that change. And I think that that's the main thing, is to know that like everyone's on board to get through the problem to solve the problem or to move through it in whatever ways it are going to be necessary. And that's not like the hope is to not introduce too much shame or a feeling of like, you know, that your parent is letting you down, like that you understand that this isn't letting you down. So that's probably what they need to feel the most.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, ultimately, when you're a kid, your job is to be a kid. Like your job isn't to take care of your parents. Your job is to be a kid. And that's, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. But I think if you feel like you're in a position to say, I love you and my love for you is not contingent upon your work. And I want to do anything I can to support you through this. That's a great thing to hear. And it's nice to have that reassurance.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you're going through such a hard time, though, and I'm sorry so many people are. This is really quite a tough time.
Yeah, it is super weird.
And I hope that it gets better soon.
Moment. John, this next question comes from Tina, who asks, dear Hank and John, when did museums become a thing? Like, did people whose houses are now museums once go to museums themselves? That would be pretty meta. Pumpkins and Penguins, Tina. John, let me know if this is true.
Okay.
Because it feels like something you would know. I imagine what happened is some rich person was like, I cannot fill the hole of worth, and so I'm going to acquire as many weird things as I can that feel valuable, and I'm going to put them in my home, and then people are going to come over to my home, and they're going to be like, look at all this cool stuff you have acquired, and I'm going to feel good about that. And then I'm going to die, and then I'm going to be like, somebody should have this, and so I'm going to give it and my money to a place that will then house it and show it off in perpetuity. That sounds to me like how a museum got started.
That is part of how museums got started. There were also these things called cabinets of curiosities that people would pay to go see, you know? So like you would pay to go see a cabinet of curiosities, and it was halfway between a sort of carnival and a contemporary museum, you know? So you'd sort of have a quasi-historical thing, but you'd also be looking at dragon bones. And so that's kind of the other strain that went into the creation of the contemporary museum. But it is very, like, when we were kids, Hank, we grew up very near this botanical garden and museum called Lou Gardens. And Lou, the house that you could, like, walk through and that there were guided tours of, and you would, it was just a guy's house. It was just a, it was a rich person's house. There was nothing else to it.
Yeah.
It was just a rich person who'd left their house to a charity that then you walk through this rich person's house and you're like, this is where this rich person ate dinner. And this is where this rich person wrote their memos. And like, this is where this rich person slept. And like, I remember like doing tours of the house and just being like, huh, it's kind of cool.
So it's a person's house.
It's kind of cool to see how people lived in the 1880s in Florida. Oh, it wasn't an easy place even to be very rich. But why is this here? Like, I understand why the gardens are there. You know, like, I understand why there are botanical gardens and everything. But I was always a little confused about the house part. And there is definitely an aspect. I mean, I think this is something that people who work in museums and people who are interested in museum studies are really grappling with right now, which is that there is a big aspect of the museum in general that is troubling by contemporary standards, both in terms of like how objects and artifacts get acquired, which artifacts are treated as art, which artifacts are treated as sort of like exotic and therefore art, even if they aren't art in their original context.
Right.
And not only that, there's also the element of like these semi-private museums. Museums that, as you say, Hank, are basically a rich person who collected a bunch of art and then got a huge tax break by giving that art, quote unquote, away while still getting to like walk through the museum of their own construction every time they want to. It's complicated. And like the relationship between extractive capitalism and museums and kind of the quote unquote art world in general is, I think, difficult for a lot of people to navigate, including me.
I hear that, John. Do you know where the word museum comes from?
I don't.
It was a school.
Oh.
It was the big university in Alexandria. It was called the Museo.
Oh. And so it's like,
which I love.
Yeah, that's nice. I still look.
And it's from the muses. So like you get the, you know, the inspirational god.
Right. I still love going to museums. I love going, and I especially love free museums that are available to everyone. And I love going to see art. And I love that there are these places that preserve art for us. But I also think we got to grapple with the complicated parts.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and you know, because of Sarah's line of work, you're pretty aware of that. And also, I think that, you know, the conversations start out small and then they get bigger and bigger until we actually kind of really do, as a society, change the way that we think and act.
Yep. That is how it tends to happen.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think there are encouraging changes happening in the world of museums, but I also think there's a ways to go. Hank, speaking of beautiful objects, let's turn our attention to football. Specifically, America's favorite third-tier English soccer team, AFC Wimbledon, which lost their most recent game, but it was like a game that we were expected to lose. We lost.
Yeah,
to...
I watched the highlights. It came up on my YouTube my YouTube page, and I was like, oh, what? And I was like, oof. That was not a game where I felt like we were, there was a chance of victory.
No, we weren't in that one. I think that's safe to say. We were not meaningfully involved in that. I was impressed that we didn't give up a goal in the first half. But before that, we played Lincoln City and we won 1-0, a game memorable for a couple reasons. First off, because it was our first league game this season where we did not give up a goal out of 14 games. So that's good. That's really encouraging. And secondly, because we won a game without first coming from behind, which I don't think we'd previously done all season.
Nice.
So we're still in 14th place, now almost a quarter of the way into the League One season. And 14th place would be an amazing result. Unfortunately, our injury woes continue. And especially in central defense, things are getting a little thin. So who knows what the next few games will bring. Will Nightingale, our long-time, long-serving central defender who's been with the club since he was 11 years old, is out for at least 3 more months. And so it's going to be a tough run of games here in the next few weeks, and we'll just have to see how we do. We do have our first round FA Cup game coming up, and this is one of the knockout competitions, the biggest knockout competition, and we will be playing a team from, I think, the 7th tier of English football, and they have a great name. It's Guiseley, or possibly Guiseley. I don't have great French.
You never know.
So funny. Pierre's French is so good. Mine is so bad. And the last thing I want to say is that our women's team played their first round FA Cup game. It was their first game at Plough Lane, which is really exciting. 1,500 people were there, which is awesome. And they won 7-1. So they are moving on to the second round of the FA Cup, where they will play Millwall, which is a much stiffer challenge than we had in the first round. But our women's team looks great this year, and I think they have every opportunity to win, and I'm really excited.
Well, good. I'm looking forward to some good goals from all the Wombles, John. In Mars news, so finally, we get to know more of what it sounds like on Mars,
yes.
Which isn't like a super high scientific priority. But so NASA has created a resource. If you go to mars.nasa.gov/Mars2020, you can listen to some of the sounds that have been recorded by the microphones. Now, they have helped scientists learn some things about Mars and learn about like changes in the atmosphere and stuff. But mostly it's like, we could put a microphone on this and why wouldn't we? But also they have, you know how like on Mars gravity is different? And so like you can type in like how much you weigh and then find out like how much you would weigh on Mars.
Right.
Well, that's also kind of true of sound. So like sounds, a thing on Mars would sound different than if it were on Earth. So you can take stuff like birds or trucks backing up or like the noise of a city, and you can put them through a system that makes it as sound as if it was happening on Mars. And you can use this like interactive tool there where you can listen to what it would sound like, different things would sound like if they were on Mars. And the sound changes based on mostly the pressure. So there's just less air molecules to bounce into each other. Mm-hmm. So that makes it quieter, but also cuts out certain wavelengths of sound. And then, and also it's colder. So that can also affect how sound travels. So if you want to find out about that, you can go to mars.nasa.gov/Mars2020.
One more time, please. Give me that URL one more time.
Oh, it's mars.nasa.gov/Mars2020.
Thank you. I'm going now. I'm excited to find out.
Enjoy yourself,
I'm excited to find out how I'm going to sound on Mars. I'm going to show. The kids will love that. That'll be so cool to share with them.
Cool.
Well, Hank, thank you for podding with me. Thanks to everybody for listening. We're off to record our Patreon-only podcast at patreon.com/DearHankandJohn. It's called This Week in Stuff. It's short and not very good. You should check it out, patreon.com/DearHankandJohn.
This podcast is edited by Joseph Tuna Medish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas, and our communications coordinator is Julia Bloom. Our editorial assistant is Devoki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola, and as they say in our hometown,
Don't forget to be awesome.